Daesh terrorists indulged in horrific crimes against innocent people. And so that project that the imperialists and the Zionists had launched, we saw how they erupted in Iraq in July of 2014. And by 2017, they were wiped out through the efforts of martyr General Qasem Soleimani.
General Soleimani was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike on January 3, 2020, while on a trip to the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. This raises the question, why should Washington kill the man who fought the terrorists in West Asia most successfully? General Soleimani was a powerful, strategic mastermind who revealed the ugly face of Western interference in both Syria and Iraq. His assassination exposed the U.S.'s support for terrorist groups and Washington's lies of countering terrorism. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was loved by people of the region as a defender of the oppressed, protecting Christians, Muslims, and those of other religions. Western-sponsored terrorist groups such as Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra sought to promote an image of Islam that was false. These groups were created by the Israeli regime and America with the financial support of Saudi Arabia. And General Soleimani was the one who confronted these deviant groups in Iraq and Syria. He managed to help the oppressed. He tried to save women, men, and children in Iraq and Syria from the crimes of Takfiri terrorists, no matter what faith they were from. He united Muslims and Christians and people of other religions in the fight against terrorists and once and for all defeated them.
Well, Daesh's tactics included killing innocent people, kidnapping women and raping them, killing children, and so on. These are things that have absolutely nothing to do with Islam. In fact, they are the very antithesis of the values of Islam that places a great premium on saving and protecting human life. So while Daesh and their backers were busy in killing innocent people, and with the deliberate policy, of course, of the imperialists and the Zionists to create a very violent and negative image of Islam, the people, obviously, the targeted people, were horrified by their actions, whether it was in Iraq or in Syria.
Millions of people in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and the rest of the world attended the funeral of General Soleimani. This shows that he is beloved by the West Asian nations and all the free people of the world. Iran marked the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of the legendary anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. In a meeting with General Soleimani's family in Tehran, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "General Soleimani has turned into a role model and a hero for the younger generation." Meanwhile, tens of thousands have taken part in ceremonies to pay tribute to the highly charismatic commander.
Soleimani was commander who did not allow the terrorists to approach our borders. He defeated Daesh in Iraq and Syria, so the entire region always owes him a big thank.
American politicians thought that by killing General Soleimani, they would be able to let the terrorists win, but we are all going to preserve his legacy.
Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the enemies were under the delusion that with the martyrdom of General Soleimani, quote, they would be done with their job. However, the U.S. fled Afghanistan as a result of the sacrifices made by Soleimani.
Afghan youth learned many lessons from him. Today, all the freedom-seeking people in the world regard him as a role model.
All Afghan people should follow his path, and he is in our hearts. We all look at him as someone who defeated arrogant powers.
Ayatollah Khamenei also said Washington is inevitably pulling out of Iraq and only has an advisory role there, without any military presence. Iran's leader warned Iraqi officials to be vigilant about the issue. On Saturday, Iraqis held rallies on the streets of the capital, Baghdad, to honor top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, both assassinated by the U.S. 2 years ago. Demonstrators called for the withdrawal of American forces from the country. Ayatollah Khamenei added the resistance front in Yemen is making gains, while the enemy has been brought to its knees in Syria. The leader, on Saturday, touched on the participation of tens of millions of people in Iraq, Iran and other countries in the funeral and the processions held for General Soleimani after his assassination. General Soleimani is hailed as a hero of the fight against terrorism by people across the globe. The Islamic movement in Nigeria described General Soleimani as a hero of coordination between Christian and Muslim religions, leading victory over Daesh in Iraq and Syria. Also, Bolivia ex-president Evo Morales described General Soleimani as a hero in the fight against imperialism. The top Iranian anti-terror commander's assassination also exposed the U.S.'s support for terrorist groups and Washington's lies of countering terrorism. Iran has called on the United Nations to adopt a resolution condemning those behind the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The Iranian President's office has made the call in a letter to the President of the UN General Assembly, saying the impunity granted to the perpetrators of the drone strike poses a threat to international peace and security. It stresses that attacks on government and diplomatic officials are crimes against humanity and violate the UN Charter and international law on human rights. It warns that inaction on state terrorism can lead to devastating consequences for the international community.
That type of extra-legal activity really was emphasized and came forward in a way that it had never seen before, basically to assassinate people in the middle of essentially a diplomatic mission in another country. And that's simply not possible to continue like that. And the response, of course, in Iraq was fury and the demand that the United States get out. So clearly, it's the wrong way to go from a whole variety of reasons, but especially a moral reason.
Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, was assassinated along with his companions, including Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a U.S. terrorist drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. But the U.S. was not alone in committing this heinous crime. Israel provided Washington with the key intelligence support, including tracking General Soleimani's cell phone. General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were two iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Both commanders were admired by Muslim nations for eliminating the U.S.-sponsored Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in the region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. Days after the brazen act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at two major military bases housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge. The U.S. assassination drew a wave of condemnation from officials and movements through the world and triggered huge public protests across the region.
The grief-stricken woman is the mother of the 14-year-old girl who died in her arms after being shot by an LAPD officer.
I have a 1 year come in from the inside, he's on the second floor.
On December 23rd, police are dispatched to a department store after receiving reports about a violent man beating up customers there with a heavy bike lock. One officer, wielding a rifle, fires shots at the assailant. But one of the bullets pierces through the dressing room's wall and hits the teenager, who's hiding there with her mother, in the chest. Valentina's body immediately goes limp. She is dead.
Right? I mean, shooting into a Burlington factory, basically a store, a clothing store, is insanity. is insanity to do so with people while people are shopping there. And yet you have officers who are doing that because they aren't thinking rationally anymore. Rational thought has gone out of the minds of many of these individuals, and it has become solely almost like a cult, like a state-sanctioned army, if you will, who is locked in arms and feels like they are being attacked from every side. And so in order to defend themselves from these attacks, they are just getting more and more violent and aggressive.
She was the fifth person killed by the LAPD forces in a 9-day period. The sixth victim survived their injuries. None of them were armed with any firearms. The incident during Christmas time sparked outrage and criticism at one of the United States' largest police departments. The Los Angeles Police Department killed more than double the number of civilians in 2021 than it did in 2020. Activists believe the rise in the number of fatalities is because the officers rarely face consequences for their actions, if at all.
I cannot breathe.
You're just a grown guy. You're a tough guy.
The death of African American George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis officer in May 2020 sent shockwaves across the United States and prompted protests against police racism and brutality. Against that backdrop, however, the number of police killings remains high. In 2021, American police killed over 1,100 people. In the 2021 calendar, there were only 12 dates on which the police didn't kill anyone. 27% of the victims over the past year have been African American. This is while the minority group constitutes only 13% of the U.S. population.
Really, what the police are trying to show here through these killings, and through it's not just through the killings, but through the market increase in the number of killings from last year to this year, is that they are the ones with the power in these cities, that they are the ones with the right or the privileges to exercise their violence. They are the ones who can shoot first and then ask questions later. They're allowed to do that.
In the meantime, while more murder and manslaughter charges have been made against police officers, criminal charges and convictions have remained exceptionally rare. 98.3% of killings by police between 2013 and 2020 have not resulted in officers being charged with a crime.
So on the one hand, even though you're seeing some of the officers get away with the violent acts that they're committing, and other ones get arrested and get sent to prison for their crimes that they committed, either way, the other officers who are watching all this happen, who are watching the attacks from the mainstream media, who are watching the attacks from the population, from the civilians, and who are watching that now their fellow brethren be locked up for crimes that they've either witnessed or committed themselves, this is causing a sort of defensive defensiveness on the part of police here in the United States, where they're uniting over their brotherhood in terms of being police officers before even uniting over their nationality, before even what it means to be an American, before what it even means to be a human being.
The families who've lost a member to police violence in the U.S. are demanding justice and accountability. Even if justice is served, they will have to live with a sobering thought that their loved ones won't ever come back.
The last savior.
Oh, the savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, we had been talking about the various tricks that the false claimants of Mehdi use in order to trap innocent people. And on that note, we have with us in our studio Dr. Murtaza Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, doctor.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dr. Karimi, it's a pleasure to have you again on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Karimi, as we had been talking about these tricks, the false claimants of Matthew Hughes in order to trap people, we talked about one of the tricks in the previous episode, that was istikhara, which means kind of, you know, taking answer from God when people are confused a lot about taking decision, and then they use Quran in order to get the answer from Allah.
That's true, yeah.
Now, I want you to expand these same tricks. Are there any more tricks these claimants use in order to trap people?
Yes, sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, we refer to a few of them, and unfortunately, there are some more to it.
A number
and,
of tricks.
Inshallah, we are going to discuss about them so that we can give a true understanding of, the true ways of recognizing the Imam, so that inshallah our dear listeners may be away from these so-called false claimants. Now, one of the tricks that is used by these false claimants, we call it to write a kind of arida. But before I talk about how they mislead the people through this trick, it's necessary for me to explain about what is arida all about.
Yeah.
Because there are some narrations regarding arida. We have some reports in our collection of hadith. So first we need to know the reality of arida. It is from the word from the root arid, which means to present something to another person, for example. Technically speaking, arida is a kind of tawassul, resorting to the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. It is a kind of dua, prayer, supplication. So sometimes you utter the words, utter your requests, but arida is in the form of a written text.
Mm-hmm.
You write down your request on a paper, and then there are some supplications to be read and recited, and then you throw that piece of paper, for example, to a river or to a well.
So this is how you rely on Imam or like whoever you want to rely on. You write a letter, you kind of put your whatever you want to say, you put it on the letter, and then you throw it in the river, and this is called arida.
This is called arida, or writing arida. Now, first of all, we need to find that whether it is to begin with an Islamic way for tawassul or not, because there are discussions regarding this, and
of
then
course.
We'll go to the what is done by the false claimant. Of course, at the time of the presence of the Imams, the Shia used to write letters, in person, and the Imams received the letters and answered them back. We are talking about our time, the period of major occultation. We have no access to the Imam of the time, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and we see some people writing down their requests, whatever they like to tell the Imam of the time, and then they throw that into a river or a well. Some people have, dedicated a special place for that. Inshallah, I will talk about that. The first one that I would like to mention is that it's not something new in the religion of Islam, because some people accuse Shia of bringing kind of bid'ah or innovation in the form of writing the arida. This is not true. We see it still common, especially among the Jews. In Baitul Maqdis or Jerusalem, there is a wall which is known as the Wailing Wall, or the Western Wall. We call it in Persian the Wall of Nutba.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that still people go there and they write down their requests and put it in the cracks in that wall.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something common before the religion of Islam. It's not something innovated by the Shia. Now, whether it is mentioned in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt or not as a way of communication of the Shia at the time of the major occultation with the Imam, their Imams or not, there are some narrations in this regard. The narrations explain how arida should be written, what are the conditions for which we are able to write arida, what is the supplication for it, and so on and so forth. But the point is that, according to some scholars, we cannot find even one absolutely authentic narration in all the narrations quoted about Arida. For example, one of the points is that the oldest source that has quoted some narrations about that is the book by Erbili, who passed away in 692. Mm-hmm. And before him, no other Shia scholar has mentioned that. And the other quotes are from Kafami, who passed away in 905 after Hijra. The other problem is with the chain of the narrations.
Okay.
I mean, the chain is not complete. So technically speaking, the narrations are mursal, meaning that some of the narrators are
not... We cannot rely on them.
Yeah, so we cannot rely on the narrations. Also, Allama Majlisi has quoted two narrations about Arida from a book, Atiq Gharawi, but today we do not have access to this book, so we cannot rely on these two narrations as well. So, if we want to talk about the authenticity of this way of tawassul from a Shia perspective, the point is that we cannot attribute it in a certain manner to the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, because, as I mentioned, the narrations are weak. So we cannot call it an Islamic tradition or even a Shia tradition to do that. But then, does it mean that it is a kind of innovation or bid'ah? Again, the answer is negative. We cannot call it a kind of innovation.
Okay.
Rather, we can do that, technically they call it for the hope of, getting reward. Mm-hmm. So it's not a recommended action rooted in authentic narrations. But because we have, although some weak narrations, the scholars say that for the recommended actions, we do tasamuh, a kind of so-called tolerance, for example, meaning that still for the recommended actions, we also, refer to the weak narrations as well. So from that perspective, we can say that people can do that, can write Arida, hoping that it is an act of worship, an act of tawassul.
An act of relying,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
So you're trying to say we have this Arida kind of thing in religion, which cannot be said that it's an innovation, and at the same time, we don't have very strong narrations supporting that.
Yeah.
Dr. Karimi, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I can hear your voice like a whisper calling me in the wind. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We are talking about the tricks used by false claimants of Mahdawiyat who claim to be attached to Imam Mahdi Ajallahu Ta'ala Faraja. Dr. Karimi, you told us about Arida, which is not an innovation, which at the same time is not very much recorded in authentic narrations. Mm-hmm. Now, how do these claimants use this process as a trick?
So the conclusion that I tried to draw from what I mentioned before the break was that, first of all, people should not think that it is based on very strong narrations, and at the same time, people should not go to another extreme and call it an innovation
or a bid'ah.
So it's very important for people not to go to extreme, because sometimes we have some people who call it a kind of superstition. This is not the case. Some people go to extreme and they believe that there are special places that are mentioned in the narrations. We need to put the Arida and the text only in those places. And one of them is, let me also talk about that before answering your question. One of them is, or rather was, a well in the Holy Mosque of Jamkaran.
All right.
And For many years, people used to go to that well and used to
write down their
and throw down the Agida into the well.
Right.
And gradually speaking, some non-Shia began to accuse the Shia that they are after superstitions. Even they forged some lies. For example, they said that some Shia believe that Imam Mahdi is residing in that well. He himself is receiving the letters which are thrown
down.
So now
the Shias were attributed with so many superstitious things.
That's the point. So what I mentioned, that we shouldn't go to extreme, that will maybe was one of the causes for that, because some people went to extreme. Some people, of course, they were very few in number, but they thought that there is something special for that will, which was not the case. And some people might even may have expected to see Imam Mahdi alayhi salam in that will, and so on and so forth.
Oh my God.
So you see, gradually speaking, it is bringing a kind of wrong understanding of the reality for the lovers of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. So is there anything specific for that will? No. It was just a well like the other wells. And according to some people, even there was no water in it. So if this is the case, even based on the narrations of Harida, you are not able to throw the Harida into that well.
You are supposed to throw an Ariza. Even if you're writing it, it should be like running water or something.
Yeah, running water, yeah. Mm. So that is why a few years ago, people in charge of the Mosque of Jamkaran decided to close that section of Jamkaran altogether, so that, I mean, they prevent these accusations against the Shia school of thought. And I think we need to appreciate that work.
Right.
So we should not go to extreme. But what is the philosophy of that? Let me also refer to this point that, I mean, psychologically speaking, we may think of some positive points. We are living in a time that we have no access to the Imam of the time. Sometimes when you are in much trouble, just to write a letter to the Imam of the time, it is, I mean, relieving you of your anxieties.
Have you ever written an Ariza?
Maybe when I was between 15 or to 17 years of old, it was the beginning years that I came to the Hausa Seminary of Qom. And I saw that people are doing that in the Mosque of Jamkaran. I think I did that once, maybe.
All right.
Yeah, and, but at that time, it was not that famous among the people. Only few people knew about that and used to do that. So my point is that even psychologically speaking, there is something positive in writing Harida. Although we may talk to Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, but some people may prefer to write down their problems, their requests, or even a kind of friendly talk to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and just throw it in the water, hoping that, I mean, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will receive that, metaphorically speaking. So I mean that it shouldn't be looked as a kind of superstition.
Even we have so many religious narrations, narrations exactly, but we have some way outs of coming out of backbiting. For example, when your heart is filled, you are troubled enough, and now you want to speak to someone. So it's better, like if you start speaking to a person after somebody's back, and now in order to like lighten up your heart, so that way you're indulging yourself into backbiting. But the best way to lighten up your heart is to write an Ariza, I guess.
That's true. That's true.
Dr. Murtaza will be talking about these tricks in the next episode. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
To listeners, you were listening to IRIB English Radio. I bid you a goodbye from my side and Dr. Murtaza's side. Take care till next episode.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? Please, oh please, please come.
Limelight. The world's 10 richest billionaires added roughly $402 billion to their collective wealth in 2021, a year marked by continued suffering and economic dislocation fueled by the global coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, In 2022, Let's Tax the Rich. 10 billionaires added $402 billion to their fortunes in 2021. Stay tuned for more. The world's 10 richest billionaires added roughly $402 billion to their collective wealth in 2021, a year marked by continued suffering and economic dislocation fueled by the global coronavirus pandemic. Heading into 2022, the 10 wealthiest individuals in the world are all worth more than $100 billion, CNBC noted, citing the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, which tracks and ranks the fortunes of the planet's richest people. Representative Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said recently that the staggering growth of billionaire wealth amid the worldwide public health emergency and economic crisis should compel Congress to finally redress the fundamental injustices of the U.S. tax system. Jayapal said, in 2022, let's tax the rich and invest in our communities. At the top of the billionaires index at the close of 2021 was Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk, who added over $121 billion to his wealth last year as the pandemic both took and completely upended lives, pushing tens of millions of people into poverty and intensifying pre-existing inequities. Just behind Musk on the list was former Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, who tacked $5 billion onto his net worth in 2021, leaving him with a total fortune of $195 billion. In November, the head of the World Food Program, WFP, outlined a proposal by which Musk, now the richest man in the world, and other U.S. billionaires could donate just 0.36% of their pandemic wealth gains to help 42 million people facing starvation. The $6.6 billion required would help those in most need in the following way. One meal a day, the basic needed to survive, costing 43 dollars per person per day. Averaged out across the 43 countries, the WFP said this would feed 42 million people for 1 year and avert the risk of famine. The billionaires have not taken the WFP up on its modest plan to save millions of lives with a fraction of their pandemic profits. The investigative outlet ProPublica reported in June that Musk, along with other U.S. billionaires, paid $0 in federal income taxes in 2018. Late last year, Musk garnered widespread publicity for selling off a portion of his Tesla stock, triggering a significant taxable event. But as Bob Lord, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, observed in a recent blog post, Musk has paid tax in 2021, lots of it because doing so was by far his best option. Did he pay more tax than any American in history, as he claims? Probably Lord wrote, but he also received compensation of more than $20 billion, which almost certainly dwarfs the compensation any other CEO in American history has ever been paid from a company with profits not remotely commensurate with that level of compensation. The updated billionaire wealth figures come as Democrats in Congress are struggling to chart a path forward for their flagship social spending and climate legislation, which has been held up by corporate-backed Senator Joe Manchin. The House-passed version of the Build Back Better Act includes a surtax on millionaires and other measures to help fund the bill's investments and reduce out-of-control inequality. According to the Washington Post, Manchin recently told the Biden White House that he would be willing to support some version of a tax targeting billionaires, an idea that the West Virginia Democrat criticized in October. While the specifics of what Manchin would support remain unclear, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden has unveiled a tax aimed at the accrued wealth of America's approximately 700 billionaires, the Post noted. The measure is aimed at addressing the massive gains of the wealthiest Americans with a federal tax and probably would be unprecedented in how few people it affected. Congress nonpartisan scorekeeper has estimated it would raise as much as $550 billion over 10 years, or pay for more than one quarter of the Democrats' spending bill. In a social media post on New Year's Day, the Patriotic Millionaires, a group composed of wealthy supporters of progressive taxation, warned that history paints a bleak picture of what happens to extremely unequal societies. For the well-being of rich and poor alike, it's time to confront inequality and choose to tax the rich, the group wrote. If you don't, then all the talk at Davos won't change what's coming. It's taxes or pitchforks.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the family cause of peace. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the family being the cause of peace in the Islamic teachings and Islamic lifestyle. Well, according to the Islamic lifestyle, it is for sure that the family is the cause of peace, especially when we talk about the husband and wife and we talk about the spouses, that in the family, they both are the cause of peace for each other. It is in a way that, for example, the wife should think about her husband, and she should have this kind of belief about her husband, that she pay attention to her husband only, and vice versa, the husband should also have the same attitude towards her wife, and in a way that they should look at each other in a way that they are most respectful, they are the most merciful for each other, they are the most loving people in the world for each other, like they do not love anyone else except them, or the most loved people are the spouses for each other, and therefore they have the modesty, the beauty, and everything is related to the spouse only and not anyone else. And this kind of thinking and this kind of perspective when someone has in the family is bringing a peace, which is a great blessing, which has been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inshallah. Welcome back. You are listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of family being the cause of peace. And we said that at the first stage, both of them, like the husband and wife, should think about each other as the most kind, as the most loved person, as the most beautiful, and we can say like the best friend, helper, the one with whom I can share all my secrets, and so on. Therefore, there are many things. What happens is basically when such a thinking comes in the family, when a family has such thinkings, it will result, when a family has such a thinking, it will result in managing the family in the best way. And therefore, they manage the family with each other's, we can say like advices. They together as a partner deals or manages the family. And I would say like, rather than saying partner, they two becoming one, they both becoming one, are basically managing the family. So being one entity, apparently it looks like it's a husband and wife, but there are two, but from inside they are spiritually one, and therefore they can manage the family in the best way. And that's the point, that when they are one, when they're together and they're dealing or managing the family as one person, then obviously if the kids are coming, if they want to train kids, if they want to raise kids, then their decisions are one. They will not have any kind of disputes. And the family, the kids, will also see that their parents, when they say something, they both are saying the same thing. And when they deal or they're trying to manage the family, they both are managing in the same way. And there is no dispute amongst them. And that is the main point of being one. When we say that the husband and wife should think, and they should accept it, that yes, even if they are two different entities, but actually they are one, and they should live with the love for each other, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The Limelight. Former President Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka visited at least twice on 6th of January 2021 in an effort to stop the attack on the U.S. Capitol, according to Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist David Edwards and has been taken from the alternet.org website. The piece is titled, Liz Cheney Reveals Ivanka Visited Donald Trump at least twice on 6th of January to stop the violence. Former President Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka visited at least twice on 6th of January 2021 in an effort to stop the attack on the U.S. Capitol, according to Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming. During an interview on ABC, Liz Cheney explained why the 6th of January Select Committee could consider criminal charges for former President Donald Trump. Liz Cheney said, "We're learning much more about what former President Trump was doing while the violent assault was underway," Cheney told ABC host George Stephanopoulos. She added, "The committee has first-hand testimony now that he was sitting in the dining room next to the Oval Office in the White House watching the attack on television as the assault on the Capitol occurred. The briefing room at the White House is just a mere few steps from the Oval Office," she continued. "The president could have at any moment walked those very few steps into the briefing room, gone on live television and told his supporters who were assaulting the Capitol to stop the attack. He could have told them to stand down. He could have told them to go home, and he failed to do so." Liz Cheney said that there was no question that Donald Trump's failure to act was a dereliction of duty. She added, "But I think it's also important for the American people to understand how dangerous Donald Trump was," she asserted. "We know, as he was sitting there in the dining room next to the Oval Office at the White House, members of his staff were pleading with him to go on television, to tell people to stop. We know that leader Kevin McCarthy was pleading with him to do just that. We know members of his own family," she added. "We know his daughter Ivanka. We have first-hand testimony that his daughter Ivanka went in at least twice to ask him to please stop the violence. Any man who would not do so, any man who would provoke a violent assault on the Capitol to stop the counting of electoral votes, any man who would watch television as police officers were being beaten, as his supporters were invading the Capitol of the United States, is clearly unfit for future office, and clearly can never be anywhere near the Oval Office ever again." Meanwhile, the former President Donald Trump awaits a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court on whether his presidential records relating to the Capitol attack should remain confidential or free for the 6th of January Select Committee to review. The twice-impeached former President Donald Trump is continuing to put out disinformation about the attack. On Wednesday, 29th of December, after news broke that the Select Committee was narrowing a portion of its records request, a decision that was mutually reached with the Biden White House, Donald Trump issued a public statement replete with lies and distortions. Trump's statement read, "The Unselect Committee of radical left Democrats and two-thirds Republicans has just dropped a large proportion of their requests for my records and documents. A very big story, even though the New York Times refused to put it on the front page." Donald Trump said in a 29th of December statement, he added, "The reason that they dropped the records request is that they don't want this horror show to happen to Biden and Hunter in 3 years' time. This also changes the entire complexion of their request. Not that there are any documents that would be incriminating or a problem for me, but the witch hunt continues. Meanwhile, the 6th of January House Select Committee has interviewed over 300 people and pored over thousands of documents relating to the 6th of January 2021 assault on the Capitol.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei, Lady Fatima was an ocean of wisdom and piety. July the 5th, 2007. Fatima al-Zahra, Salamullah alayha, is superior to all great and saintly women throughout history. What factors, forces, and what kind of inner strength could make a person become such an ocean of wisdom, piety, sanctity, and spiritual transcendence in such a short time? This is a miracle of Islam. The love of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, also known as Siddiqatul Kubra, is a great blessing for us. In her short life, Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, achieved the position of the mistress of all women. In other words, she is superior to all great and saintly women throughout history. What factors, forces, and what kind of inner strength could make a person become such an ocean of wisdom, piety, sanctity, and spiritual transcendence in such a short time? Well, this is a miracle of Islam. Another point is the blessed descendants of this great person. The association of Suratul Kawthar with Fatima al-Zahra, even if such an association had not existed in our hadith collections, is an accurate association. There are so many blessings that have been bestowed on the Holy Prophet's household and on each and every one of the Imams, alayhim as-salam.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The world is full of enjoyable individual, social, worldly and otherworldly melodies which came out of the pure throats of the Imams, alayhim as-salam, حسين بن علي, زينب الكبرى, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, Imam Sadiq, Imam Sajjad, and each and every one of the Imams alayhim as-salam would produce these melodies. See what a great excitement exists in the world of spirituality and in the path of guidance because of the words of these great personalities and their lessons and teachings. They are the children of Fatimah al-Zahra alayha salam. We should sincerely thank God. A number of the poems which are recited by the friends contained this point. The love of Fatimah al-Zahra alayha salam, also known as Siddiqat al-Kubra, is a great blessing for us. Thank God we became familiar with her. Thank God we relied on her kindness, and thank God we appreciated her value. Thank God we relied on her, asked her to help us gain an understanding of things, and expressed our love for her. These are great blessings. We should preserve these blessings. That was the leader's speech from July the 5th, 2007.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stressed on the need of unity among Muslims and called on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the US to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam, like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the